The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Dessie! It has withdrawn!
Withdrawn?
It has receded!
Tsunami! It's a tsunami!
Working on a dig on the southern coast of India, the last thing Anya Creed expects is to be hit by a tsunami or to strike archaeological gold.
Hey! Look what I found!
Let me see that. It appears to be a mechanism of some sort.
Is it gold?
I believe so, yes.
Anya watched as Lochata's fingers found the hidden release inside the egg-shaped device. The device split open like the sections of an orange to reveal the figurine inside. It was a woman, at least from the waist up, but below the waist, she was a snake. Anya is driven to discover the source of the relics at the bottom of the sea. Unfortunately, she isn't the only one interested in the mysterious artifacts.
Where is Anya Creed? If someone does not tell me where this woman is, I'm going to set your ship on fire and kill every person aboard it!
I'm here.
Miss Creed.
I am Rajiv Shivaji. Do you still have the figurines?
No.
I don't believe you. Do you really want me to kill all those people because you like me?
No.
Master Rajiv! Look! It's the Coast Guard!
They've underestimated me, Miss Creed, and they're about to pay for that.
Taken hostage by the pirate Shivaji, Anya finds herself on a river deep in the Indian jungle.
You know about Kumarikam Dam?
It was a mythical kingdom out in the Indian Ocean.
Not mythical. Once it was very real. A proud and fierce people lived there for a long time, and they amassed a vast fortune. As the island began to sink, the people abandoned their city and fled to the mainland. They took the contents of the treasure room with them.
There!
There! Men! Pull to shore!
We must find a throne room. That's where the treasure is supposed to be kept.
But the deserted ruin isn't deserted, and the residents don't like strangers. Rogue Angel number 10, Serpent's Kiss.
Indeed. Death to the Americans. The United States supported Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The Americans helped the Shah stay on his peacock throne to oppress and defile the people of Iran. Some of you were but children when the Savak carried innocent people away to be tortured and murdered. Yet, God is great. You smote the American pawn in Iran. You began the Islamic Holy War against the great Satan. Saddam Hussein carried it forward. Saddam's armies fought the infidel nations of the West. God is good, for now we take holy war to the Americans!
A sudden wave of global terrorism has all the hallmarks of an Islamic jihad. Stony Man goes on red alert to determine if these atrocities are state-sponsored, carried out to draw the U.S. into full-scale war.
So Horan has poison in his veins. I assume that means he won't give up and will sacrifice as many lives as possible if he thinks there's no way out.
Major Horan carries death inside him. He will spread death as if a contagious disease. I think he wants to do this. Death is Horan's only concept of victory.
And he's gonna get a personal victory. And his last.
Oh, this neighborhood seems to be getting worse.
I noticed.
Your hand grenade seems to have made an impression on them. Maybe another one will discourage them from rushing the building.
Let's see what two will do.
Able Team, Phoenix Force, and Mac Bolan join forces across the globe as Armageddon is about to become a reality.
I hate to harp on this, but they've probably got vats of chlorine, cyanide, various types of acid, and maybe tanks of concentrated hydrogen and oxygen gases.
Meaning we can get poisoned, blown up, and burned to a crisp all at once if we're not careful.
We're trying not to hit anything with bullets. I just hope nobody inside is suicidal.
Join the warriors of Stony Man Farm in an action-packed race against time in Stony Man Number 4.
You don't object to murder?
Not murder. Justice.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man 8, Preacher. Narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by Colleen Delaney, Richard Rowan, Terrence Hazelford, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Karen Carbone, Johann Detweiler, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, Elizabeth Demery, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, Kate Torrey, Andy Clements, James Lewis, Eric Mesner, Lily Beacon, and MJ Casey.
Brother? You awake? Hey, brother?
Leaving his brother sleeping in the bed behind him, the boy stepped out of the bedroom and into the upstairs hallway. He moved down to the end of the hall to his parents' bedroom.
I can hear you snoring, Pa. I know it's 'cause you work so hard.
His ma was in there too, though her rhythmic breathing couldn't be heard over her husband's snores. She was always the last to go to bed and the first to get up. It was nearly 2 hours before dawn now, but Art knew that his mother would be rolling out of bed in less than an hour, starting another of the endless procession of backbreaking days that were the borders of her life.
Ma, Pa, I want you both to know that I ain't leaving because of nothing either of you have done. You've been good to me, and there ain't no way I can ever pay you back for all that you've done for me or let you know how much I love you. But the truth is, I got me a hankering to get on with my life, and I reckon 12 years is long enough to wait.
Art moved down the steps to his two sisters' room. He went into their room and saw them sleeping together in the bed his father had made for him. A silver splash of moonlight fell through the window, illuminating their faces. One was sucking her thumb, a habit she practiced even in her sleep. The other was clutching a corncob doll. The two girls, 8 and 9, snuggled down into the sheet but didn't awaken.
I reckon I'm going to miss seeing you two girls grow up, but I'll always keep you in my mind, along with Ma and Pa and brother. Goodbye.
Art picked up the pillowcase in which he had put a second shirt, another pair of pants, 3 biscuits, and 1 apple, and started toward the head of the stairs. Although he had been planning this adventure for a couple of months, he didn't make the decision to actually leave until 3 days ago. On that day, he stood on a bluff and watched a flatboat drift down the Ohio River, which flowed past the family farm. There was a family on the flatboat, holding on tightly to the little pile of canvas-covered goods that represented all their worldly possessions. One of the boat's passengers, a boy about Art's age, waved. Other than the wave, there had been nothing unusual about that particular boat. It was one of many similar vessels that passed by the farm every week. To anyone else, seeing an entire family uprooted and looking for a new place to live, traveling the river with only those possessions they could carry on the boat with them, might have been a pitiful sight. But to Art, it was an adventure that stirred his soul, and he wished more than anything that he could be with them.
Oh, it's just the clock.
The beautifully decorated clock, which sat on the mantel over the fireplace, was the family's most prized possession. His mother had once told him with great pride that someday the clock would be his. Art reckoned now that it would go to his brother. Well, his brother always put more store in the clock than he did anyway. Recovering his poise, Art took a piece of paper from his pocket. It was addressed to Ma and Pa. At first, he hadn't planned to tell anyone in his family that he was leaving. He was just gonna go, and when his folks woke up for the next day's chores, they would find him gone. But at the last minute, he thought his parents might rest a little easier if they knew he had left on his own and had not been stolen in the middle of the night. Art had enough schooling to enable him to read and write a little. He wasn't that good at it, but he was good enough to leave a note.
Ma and Pa, don't look for me, for I have went away. I am near a man now, and I want to be on my own. Love, your son, Arthur.
He put the note on the mantle next to the clock. Art stepped out onto the porch and moved quickly down the path that led to the river. When he reached the bluff, he turned and looked back. The house loomed large in the moonlight, a huge dark slab against the dull gray of the night. The window to his parents' bedroom was gleaming softly in the moonlight. It looked like a tear-glistened eye. A lump came to Art's throat. His eyes stung. For a moment, he actually considered abandoning his departure plans.
No. I ain't going to stand here and cry like a baby. I said I'm a-going, and by damn I'm going. Sorry about saying damn, Ma, but I reckon if I'm going to be a man, I'm going to have to start talking like a man.
Art left the beaten path, then picked his way through the brush down the side of the bluff to the river's edge. To the casual observer, there was nothing there. But when Art started pulling branches aside, he uncovered a small skiff. He had found the boat earlier in the year during the spring runoff. No doubt, it had broken from its mooring sometime when the river was at freshet stage, though it was impossible to ascertain where it had come from. Art didn't exactly steal the boat, but he did hide it, even from his father. And he assured himself that if someone had come looking for the boat, he would have disclosed its location. But as no search materialized, at least none of which he was aware, he got to keep the boat. The boat provided him with a golden opportunity, and it wasn't until it came into his possession that he seriously began considering running away from home. He was leaving, not because of any abuse, but because of pure wanderlust. If he put into the current now, some 2 hours before dawn, he would be 6 miles downriver by sunrise. By sundown, he would be 40 miles away. He pulled it out of its hiding place and towards the river. Underway now, he looked back toward the bank and saw that he was moving at a fairly good clip. It wasn't until that moment that he realized this might well be the last time he would ever set eyes on the land of his birth. But that realization did not weaken his resolve. Art had an oar, but as the current was swift and steady, no rowing was required. So he used the oar as a tiller to keep the boat centered in the river. The boat moved downstream much more swiftly than he would have thought. By twilight, he was already farther from home than he had ever been in his life. He ate a biscuit and watched the sun set from the middle of the river. The orb flamed a wide, fan-shaped bank of clouds, turning them into a brilliant orange gold. The river itself took on a light, translucent blue, as pretty as he had ever seen it. He began looking for a good place to put in and saw a fallen tree lying half in and half out of the water's edge. He rowed over to the tree and tied his boat to it. Using the tree's branches to hide the boat from view, Art stretched out in the bottom. He ate the second of his 3 biscuits and went to sleep. 2 days later, the biscuits and his apple gone, he was feeling mighty hungry. He saw several boats gathered beneath a high bluff. Halfway up the bluff was a large cave, and a hand-lettered sign explained that this was Eby's River Trading Post. Even from the boat, he could smell the enticing aroma of roasted meat. Art had no money, but he was, as I said, mighty hungry, so he paddled ashore. He tied the boat up to an exposed tree root, then walked up the path toward the mouth of the cave. A few wide boards supported by upright wooden barrels formed a counter that stretched across the front of the cave. Behind it, in the cave itself, were several shelves and boxes and barrels of goods, from whiskey to clothing, flour, bacon, beans, and taters. A red-faced, rather plump man was manning the counter, and when Art walked up, the man came toward him.
What can I do for you, sonny?
You have food here?
You see those women by the fire? What's the matter with you, boy? You can't smell it?
Oh, I can smell it.
Sonny, you ask anybody up and down the whole Ohio, and they'll tell you that Eby's got near about anything you could want. We got roast pork, chicken, rabbit, squirrel, and possum. We got fried dove, catfish, and carp. We got biscuits, cornbread, beans, taters, and gravy. You go back down and tell your ma she don't have to cook no supper tonight because we got anything she might want right here. Yes, sir. For 10 cents, you can feast like a king.
Are you Mr. Eby?
Mr. Eby? No, many folks call me Mr. But yeah, I'm Eby. Now, you gonna run down and tell your ma what I said?
My ma's not here.
Well, who is here? Your pa?
Ain't nobody here but me.
You mean a boy like you is out here traveling on his own with no family?
I'm near to full growed. By damn, I reckon I can travel without a family if I want to.
Oh, boy, don't be taking no offense to my palaverin'. Your dime's as good as the next fella's, I reckon. What'll you have?
I'd love some pork and beans.
Why, sure, boy. Just show me your dime and I'll serve it right up to you.
Well, that's just it, mister. I ain't got no dime. I ain't got no money at all.
You ain't got no money?
No, sir.
Well, now, if you ain't got no money, would you mind telling me just how the Sam Hill you was planning on eating?
I thought maybe I could work some for it.
Boy, I got no need for someone to work for me. I got me two women back there, as you can see. They're all the workers I need, and they don't cost me nothing. One of them being my wife, and the other being her sister.
Do you know of anyone who needs any work done? Now, I'm a good worker. I'm strong. I've been carrying my own load for the better part of 3 years now.
This here ain't no hiring hall. If you got a dime, I'll give you some supper. If you ain't got no money, then get the hell out of here and don't be taking up space.
Give the boy something to eat.
I ain't giving him nothing if he don't pay for it.
Fair enough.
Art turned to see a tall, bearded man fish something out of his pocket.
Here's your goddamn dime. Now give the boy some victuals.
No, sir. I thank you kindly, sir, but I don't aim to take no charity.
Who said anything about charity? I've got a flatboat down here loaded with goods that I'm taking to the Louisiana Territory. If you're willing to work for your keep, I'll take you on.
Yes, sir. I'll have me that pork and some beans now. Oh, and maybe some taters.
Scowling, Eby went back to the cooking fire, spooned up some beans and potatoes, cut off some pork, and put it on a tin plate. He brought the plate and a spoon back to the counter.
Thanks, sir.
Seems to me like there ought to be a biscuit with that, Eby.
Eby grudgingly reached under a cloth and pulled out a biscuit, then set it beside the plate.
Name's Harding. Pete Harding. What's yours?
Art.
Art? That's all?
Art thought for a moment. Harding seemed to be a nice man. Certainly he had bought a meal and was promising employment. But Art was planning on making a clean break from his past. He didn't want anything that would make that connection, including the last name.
Art's all the name I use.
Well, if Art's good enough for you, then I reckon it's good enough for me. How'd you get here anyway? Did you walk?
No, sir. I come by boat.
Well, after you eat your supper, come on down and help me get loaded up. Then, if you're a mind to go with me, why, I reckon you can tie your boat on behind, or else leave it here.
Oh, hey, boy, you got a boat you want to leave here. I'll keep it for you till you get back. We'll charge you but a dollar to keep it for a whole month.
Yeah, and a pig's eye you will. Boy, you don't have any money at all?
No, sir. And I'm not a boy.
I hear you. Well, if that boat don't mean nothing personal to you, why don't you just sell it? That way you can go on downriver with me and have a little money besides.
Sell the boat? Why, I reckon I don't need it no more. I sure would like to sell it.
All right, then. Ebi, what do you give the boy for the boat?
50 cents.
It's worth $5.
Not to me, it ain't.
As many people as you got coming through here, you could give the boy $5 for the boat, then turn right around and sell it within a week to someone else for $7.
I'll give the boy $3.
Four.
All right, $4.
What do you think, son? It's your boat and your decision.
$4? I ain't never had that much money in my life. Yeah, I'll sell it.
Give the boy $4.
Where's the boat?
I'll take you to it.
We'll take you to it. Now, Art, after you make the transaction, we've got work to do.
Yes, sir.
Harding had unloaded his goods in order to do some business with the folks who had tied up at the trading post. It took no more than half an hour to get him loaded back onto his boat. It was a flatboat, nearly as wide as it was long, with a small cabin at mid-deck. A long tiller, which could also be used to propel the boat, stuck out from behind. Every available square inch of the boat was covered with cargo. Bales of cloth, pots, pans, various kinds of tools, barrel staves, hoops, and three cases of Bibles.
All right, Art. It's time for us to get going.
We're going to run the river at night?
No, we'll put in a couple miles downstream. It'll be safer than staying here, what with the river pirates.
River pirates?
Harding's searching look covered both sides of the river, into the rocks and behind the trees.
They like to hang around river stops, like trading posts and the like. That way they can get a good look at what the boats are carrying. And if they see anything they like, they'll go cross-country till they can find a place to set up an ambush. What with the river meandering back and forth, it's easy enough for them to get ahead of a boat.
You mean there might be pirates here right now?
Truth to tell, boy, I wouldn't put it past E.B. himself. I've always suspected him, but I've never been able to prove it. If I ever got proof, I'd get some of the other boatmen together and we'd clean this place out.
Harding cast off the line, then using the tiller, worked the boat out into the center of the river. He pointed it downstream, and as had been the case with Art's skiff, the current provided all the propulsion they needed. The only difference was that the flatboat didn't travel quite as fast as the skiff.
Come here, son.
Yes, sir.
Here, take the tiller. Might as well start learning right off.
Yes, sir.
Art took the tiller in his own hands. He could feel the surge of the water and the control he had over the boat. It was similar to what he experienced with the skiff, though as the flatboat was bigger, tiller longer, and with more surface area, he felt a much greater pull.
Hey, you're doing a good job.
Harding sat down on a bale of cloth and reached into his pocket. He pulled out a pipe, filled it with tobacco, then using a flintlock and a steel mechanism, managed to get his pipe lit.
How far do we go before we put in?
Are you tired already?
No, sir. I just meant... Well, I just wondered, that's all.
And not much longer. Run away from home, did you?
No, I... Yes, sir. I ran away.
Trouble at home?
No, I just wanted to...
You wanted to see the creature, didn't you?
See the creature?
Now, that's just a saying, son. It's a saying for folks like us.
Like us?
You and me. There are some folks who are born, live, and die, and never get more than 10 miles away from home in any direction. And there's folks that's always wondering what's on the other side of the next hill. And when they get over that hill, why, damn me, if they don't feel like they got to go on to the next one. And the next one, and the next one after that. They're always hoping they'll find something out there. Some sort of creature they ain't never seen before. I know it's that way with me.
Yes, sir. I'd say it's that way with me, too.
Pull in over there. We'll camp here tonight.
Get up, boy!
Art was jerked awake as someone grabbed him and pulled him from the bale of cloth he was using for a bed. It was still dark, but in the ambient light of the moon, Art could see that two men were holding Harding. One of the men had the point of his knife sticking into Harding's neck, far enough that a little trickle of blood was streaming down. One flick of the hand and Harding would bleed his life away in seconds. The third man, the one who had so abruptly awakened Art, was now holding Art's arm twisted behind him. He put pressure on the arm and Art winced in pain, but he didn't cry out.
What do we do with the kid?
Knock him in the head and throw him overboard.
Art's captor was holding a club, and he raised it over Art's head in order to accomplish the task.
No, wait. Evie told me he'd give the boy $4 for that boat. Check his pockets. He ain't had no chance to spend it yet.
Is that right, boy?
Art's captor turned to him. Two of his teeth were missing, and his breath was foul.
You got $4 on you?
The man started to put his hand into Art's pocket, but in order to do so, he had to loosen his grip. That was all that was needed, because as soon as the grip was relaxed, Art twisted away and jumped into the river beside the boat.
Hey!
God damn it, Percy, you let him get away!
Couldn't help it, Dinkus. Little son of a bitch was slick as a greased hog. Well, what do we do with Harden?
Well, we know he's got some money because Evie's seen him doing a lot of business back at the trading post.
That right, Harden? You got yourself a poke somewheres out this here boat?
If I did, I wouldn't tell you, you sorry sack of shit.
No, I think you'll tell us. Break one of his fingers, Clyde. Ah!
This close to the bank, the river was only about chest deep, but it was dark and Art moved up under the curve of the boat keel so he couldn't be seen by those on board.
Harding, we know you got the money hid on the boat, and you know that we're gonna find it. All we're asking is that you make it easier on us, and we'll make it easier on you.
Yeah, we'll be real nice to you. We'll kill you fast instead of slow.
Go to hell.
You got 10 fingers and 10 toes. And old Clyde there, he's the kind of fella that likes to make other folks hurt. So you can tell us now, or you could just let Clyde bust you up one bone at a time until you do.
Carefully and quietly, Art pulled himself back onto the boat, boarding it at the bow. Harding and the three men were back at the stern. Art had no idea why he was doing this. Every impulse and nerve in his body was screaming at him to run. The night was dark enough, and the woods by the riverbank were thick enough that he could easily get away from them. And yet, here he was, back on the boat. Keeping low and staying behind the bales of cargo, Art slipped into the mid-deck cabin from the front end. He knew exactly what he was looking for, because he had seen him earlier that afternoon. It was considerably darker inside the cabin than it was on the deck of the boat. Art couldn't see 6 inches in front of his face, so he had to do everything by feel. On the other hand, there was some advantage to that, because even if the pirates were looking right at him, they wouldn't be able to see him. Art's fingers closed over what he was looking for. 2 fully charged, primed, and loaded 50 caliber pistols. Hammer's back, he moved to the stern door of the little cabin. He was less than 10 feet away from the pirates, but they still couldn't see him.
Oh, he ain't gonna tell us nothing, Dinkus.
I reckon you're right. We may as well kill him now and get it over.
Dinkus drew back his knife, ready to plunge it into Harding's chest.
What the hell?
Only Harding was jolted into action. Dropping to one knee, he grabbed Dinkus' knife, then with a quick underhand flip of the wrist, threw the knife at Clyde. The knife buried itself in the pirate's neck. Only seconds before, Percy had been one of 3 armed rivermen, easily in command of the situation. Now he was the only one left, and he realized that his position had suddenly become perilous. He raised his own knife and started toward Harding. Harding rolled to his right.
Mr. Harding, here!
Harding caught the gun Art tossed him and spun towards Percy. Percy's body floated away, leaving a thick black stream of blood in the water behind him. Harding checked the 2 men who were still on board. He leaned down over Dinkus.
Is he dead?
Ted is a doornail. You did a job on him, boy.
Art couldn't look away from Deacus's face. His features were frozen in a rictus of pain. Art felt lightheaded, and his stomach rebelled.
Oh.
He rushed to the edge of the boat just in time.
Sorry.
It's all right. Happens to everybody, Art.
Oh.
Anyway.
Harding hauled up one of the river pirates' bodies.
Get the hell off my boat! God damn it. You. Two! Break my fingers, will you?
Art walked to Harding's side and looked down at the dead pirates in the water.
Are we just going to leave them there?
Hell yes, we're going to leave them there. You don't think I'm going to take the time to dig graves for those sons of bitches, do you?
No, sir, I guess not.
Let the alligator garfish feed on their sorry carcasses. I just wish they weren't quite dead yet so they could feel it.
Yes, sir.
Well, it'll be getting light soon. We might as well get underway. Untie the forward line.
Art picked his way to the bow, then untied the line that held them secure to an overhanging branch. Harding pulled them away from the bank, then out into the river. After they reached midstream, the current took over, and once more, they moved rapidly down the river.
Take the tiller, boy. I gotta tend to this hand.
Art watched as Harding pulled on both his fingers, grimacing in pain as he straightened them out. After that, he rummaged through the little pile of firewood until he found a stick just the right size.
Hey, Art.
Yes, sir?
Come over here.
Yes, sir?
Take some of that rawhide cord there and bind these fingers to this here splint.
Art started to do what Harding said.
Ah!
Oh, I'm sorry, sir.
Don't stop, boy, else I'll have a couple of useless hooks here instead of fingers. Do it pretty tight. It's gonna hurt a mite, but I'll be the one hurting, not you.
Yes, sir.
Not so tight that it cuts off the blood, though.
Art nodded, then finished the task, cutting off the rawhide and tying it secure. Harding held out his hand and looked at it.
Doubt there's a doctor this close to St. Louis who could have done a better job. I'm proud of you, boy.
I'm glad I could help.
Art went back to the tiller. By now, the sky had turned to dove gray, and streaks of pink slashed through the eastern sky. Harding got a fire going, then disappeared into the cabin. He came out a moment later with a pot, which he placed over the fire. After a few minutes, the rich aroma of brewing coffee permeated the boat.
Coffee comes so dear that I don't generally drink it, except on Sundays. But I reckon this occasion is special enough for us to have something this morning.
What's the occasion?
Well, you saved my life. Now, that might not be all that much of an occasion to some folks, but it sure is to me.
I didn't do much.
The hell you say. Once you went over the side of the boat and into the water, you could have kept on going and they never would have found you. But you came back. You saved my life.
I wish I hadn't had to.
Kill a man?
Yes, sir.
First time you ever had to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course it is, you being no older than you are. How old are you, Art?
16.
Yeah.
All right. I'm 13. Well, nearly so anyway.
Well, nearly 13. So that means what? That you're 12?
Yes, sir.
Coffee's ready. Here you are.
Thank you.
You used to having milk and sugar in your coffee?
Milk. Sometimes a little syrup or honey.
Well, you'd best get used to having it black. You see, you can pretty near always have coffee with you. You can't always have milk or sugar.
It's good.
You're gonna do fine, boy. And don't worry none about that no-count son of a bitch you killed. His kind always die young. If you hadn't killed him, someone else would have.
I just wish it hadn't been me.
Listen to me, boy. He may have been the first one you've killed, but he won't be the last one you're gonna have to kill. Not by a long shot. Not if you're gonna survive out here. You've got to realize that and not dwell none on it. Maybe you are only 12 years old by the calendar, but today, you showed me you're a man.
Because I killed someone?
No, any fool can kill. But you came back to help me. when you could have easy gotten away. There's lots more things that go into making a man than the number of years someone has lived. Live long enough and the years will come to everyone. The other things, honor, duty, and knowing how to do what's right, don't come to everyone. But they don't come to you. Let nobody tell you different, Art. You're a man now. And I'm glad to call you my friend.
Harding stuck out his hand. Art started to shake it, then remembered the broken fingers and pulled back. Then he realized that the broken fingers were on Harding's left hand. Smiling, he gave Harding a good, strong grip.
So the Ohio River connects to the Mississippi, which is where we are now.
One of the first things Art noticed was a number of felled trees. During his trip down the Ohio, he had seen maybe as many as 100 downed trees. But here, there were literally thousands of trees on the ground.
I've never seen such a thing.
Well, boy, you left home to see the wonders of the world. This is one of them.
But how can this be? Was there such a wind that it could blow this many down?
It wasn't the wind that did it. It was the trembling earth.
Trembling earth?
Shakers. Some folks call them earthquakes. What happens is, the ground just starts to shaking something awful. Shaking so bad a fella can't even stand up.
You seen such a thing?
Yep. Happened a couple years ago. Trees was falling and the earth was opening up. Sulfur commenced spewing into the air. All the shaking and trembling made the Mississippi River flow backward, and it pushed it right out of its channel for a bit to form a new lake.
I sure would like to see something like that.
Well, when we get to New Madrid, don't tell any of them folks that. I reckon they've seen enough of it over the last couple of years.
Is that where we're going? New Madrid?
Yep, it's in the Missouri Territory.
What's there?
New Madrid is a good marketplace. Folks buy there, then take it to St. Louis, or on down to New Orleans. I plan to sell everything I got on this here boat. Then I'm going to sell the boat. Then, after a couple days of raising hell and having a good time, I'll buy myself a horse, ride back to Ohio, get me another boatload of goods, come down here to do the same thing all over again.
You're going back to Ohio?
Sure am. That's where I can get goods the cheapest. The trick in this or any business is to buy cheap and sell high. What about you? You're sure welcome to come along with me. You can be my partner if you want to.
I
know. You don't have to say it. You're anxious to see the creature.
I reckon I am.
Well, I can't say as I blame you. And as long as you're planning on seeing the creature, why, I figure New Madrid is as good a location as any to start.
New Madrid was a booming town of nearly 3,000 people, spread out along the west bank of the Mississippi River. There were nearly 100 flatboats and scores of skiffs tied up along the riverbank, and less than 100 feet from the river's edge on a street called Water Street, nearly as many wagons, carts, horses, and mules were passing by. The wooden structures of the town were built right up against each other. Leather goods stores, trading posts, cafes, and taverns. Art realized that, like the trees, the earthquake must have also destroyed New Madrid. That was the only way he could explain the fresh lumber appearance of all the buildings. Even now, half a dozen new buildings were going up. Whether they were a sign of the town's growth and progress, or merely the reconstruction of destroyed buildings, he didn't know. Waters and Mill Street, two streets that ran parallel with the river, were crowded with people, visitors, as well as permanent residents. It didn't take Harding long to sell his goods at all. Once his task was accomplished, he came back to Art, holding a handful of money. He counted out $10 in silver and handed it to Art.
What's this for?
Your wages. You earned them.
But I was only with you for a couple of weeks. You fed me and gave me transportation. You don't need to pay me as well.
Son, you're gonna have to learn your own value. Anytime you sell your services to someone, sell them for as much as you can get. Well, if you're gonna argue, argue for more, not less.
Yes, sir.
Besides, whether you did $10 worth of labor isn't the question. You saved my life, and that's certainly worth $10 to me. Now, do you want the money or not?
I want the money.
I thought you might come around. Now, since you'll soon be going your way and I'm going mine, what do you say we go to a dram shop and have a beer?
A beer. Well, I...
Hells bells, boy. You gonna tell me you don't like beer?
I don't know. I've never had a beer.
You've never had a beer?
No, sir. My mom didn't hold with drinking. Not even beer.
Well, what do you think about it?
I never did give it much thought one way or t'other.
Then it's time you did give it some thought. You got some catching up to do. Come on. It'll be a pleasure for me to buy you your first beer.
The sign in front of the building read Watson's Dram Shop. Inside the saloon was a pot-bellied stove that, though cold now, still had the smell of smoke about it from its winter use. A rough-hewn bar ran across one end of the single room, while half a dozen tables completed the furnishings. The room was illuminated by bars of sunlight shining in through the windows and open door. Flies buzzed about the room, especially drawn to those places where there was evidence of spilt beer.
Mr. Hardy, good to see you back in New Madrid again.
The man behind the bar was wearing a stained apron over his clothes and a green top hat over a shock of red hair.
Hello, Mr. Watson. I hope you haven't sold all your beer.
I just got a new shipment down from St. Louis. What about the boy?
Don't let his looks and age fool you. Art's as good a man as I've ever come across. I reckon he'll have beer, too. That right?
Yes, sir. I'll have a beer.
Art watched as the mug filled with a golden fluid, topped by a large head of white foam.
Here you go, boy.
Thank you, sir.
Well, how is it?
It's, I don't know. I'll have to taste it again.
Well, here's to you, Art.
Harding raised his own beer out toward Art. For a moment, Art didn't understand what he was doing. But when Harding tapped his mug against Art's, he realized it was some sort of ritual, so he followed along. Art drank all of that beer, and then another.
Ah, let's go.
Where are we going?
There's a certain etiquette on spending money in a town like New Madrid, and part of it is that you spread your money around. Well, this is my favorite place, but if I spend all my money with Watson, then he's liable to start taking me for granted, while all the other places will be resentful. You see what I mean?
I guess so.
Besides, we all have our own way of looking for the creature. I've always been of the opinion that it might be in the next dram shop.
Art followed Harding up the boardwalk toward the next drinking establishment. A wagon rolled by on the street. Driving the wagon was a tall, raw-boned man dressed in black. He had beady eyes, high cheekbones, a hooked nose, and a prominent chin. A short, stout, very plain-looking woman was sitting on the bench beside him. The wagon had bows and canvas, but the canvas was rolled back at least two bows. As a result, Art could see the third occupant of the wagon, a girl about his own age. She was sitting on the floor with her back leaning against the wagon side opposite from Art. As a result, when he glanced toward her, he saw that she was looking directly at him. For a moment, their gazes held. Then, embarrassed at being the recipient of such scrutiny, Art looked away.
Ah, here we go. Let's pay a visit to Mr. Cooper.
Cooper's saloon was almost an exact copy of Watson's, with a bar and a few tables and chairs. However, there was a card game in progress here, and Harding joined it. Card playing was another of the vices his mother had warned him against. But as beer drinking was proving to be a rather pleasant experience, Art decided he would investigate card playing as well. So, drinking yet another beer, he leaned against the wall and watched the card game. As he stood leaning against the wall, Art happened to see a pick-and-switch operation lift a man's wallet. The victim was a middle-aged man who was standing at the bar, drinking his beer while carrying on a conversation with another man. A nimble-fingered pickpocket deftly slipped the victim's billfold from his back pocket. At that moment, a big, black-bearded man came in through the door, and Art watched as the pickpocket passed the pilfered wallet off to the man who had just come in. The entire operation was so quick and smooth that the victim never felt a thing. No one else in the saloon saw it happen, and if Art had not been in the exact spot at the exact time he was there, he wouldn't have seen it either. The accomplice walked directly to the table where Harding and three others were playing cards.
May I join you, gentlemen?
Sure, have a seat. Your money's as good as anyone else's. What do you say about that, Art? Isn't his money as good as anyone else's?
It would be, I suppose, if it was really his money. Trouble is, it isn't. He stole it.
What did you just say, boy?
I said it isn't your money.
And what the hell do you mean by that?
Yes, Art, what do you mean?
Art looked toward the bar. Nearly everyone in the place had heard his remark, and now all were looking toward him with intense interest.
Well, this man, has that man's poke.
He pointed to the middle-aged man who was standing at the bar. It wasn't until that moment that the man standing at the bar checked his pocket.
What the hell? My poke is missing.
I don't know what this boy is talking about. Hell, I just this minute come in here. I haven't even been close to the bar.
Well, he's right. I just seen him come in.
If somebody took that man's money, it wasn't me.
Oh, you didn't take it.
Boy, you ain't making a hell of a lot of sense. First you accuse Riley there of taking McPherson's poke, now you say he didn't do it.
Now hold on, Cooper. Don't be kicking us out of your bar just yet. Art, what's going on?
I said he has the poke. I didn't say he took it.
Art pointed to the original pickpocket, who was now at the far end of the bar trying to stay out of sight.
That's the man who took it. He picked the man's pocket, then gave it to Mr. Riley when he came in.
By God, I don't care if you are just a pup. Fella doesn't go around accusing another fella of something less than he can prove it.
I can describe my purse if that'll help. It's made of pigskin and it's sewed together with red yarn. My wife made it for me.
Well, this seems like a simple enough problem to solve. So why don't you just empty your pockets on the table? If you don't have it, then we'll just go on about our business.
What? To hell with that! I ain't going to empty my pockets just because of some snot-nosed boy's lie.
Art, you're sure about this?
I'm sure.
Right. Empty your goddamn pockets.
Wait a minute. You're going to take this boy's word over mine?
Yeah, I reckon I am. See, here's the thing, Riley. I don't know you from Adam's off mule, but I do know this boy, and he's already proved himself to me. Truth be told, I reckon I'd take his word over that of my own mama. Now empty your goddamn pockets on the table, or by God, I'm gonna grab you by the ankles, turn you upside down, and empty them for you.
The only thing you're going to empty is your guts.
Look out! He's got a knife!
Everyone else backed away to give the two belligerents room. Riley held his knife out in front of him, moving it slowly back and forth like the head of a threatening snake. Harding pulled his own knife. Then the two men stepped away from the table to do battle. They raised up onto the balls of their feet, then crouched forward slightly at the waist. Each man had his right arm extended, holding his knife in an upturned palm. Slowly, they moved around each other, as if engaged in some macabre dance. The points of the knives moved back and forth, slowly, hypnotically. Art watched them. The fight with the river pirates had been deadly, but it had also been quick and spontaneous. This was the first time he had ever seen two men fight face to face, each with the grim determination to kill the other. Although he had a vested interest in the outcome, for surely if Riley killed Harding, he would then turn on Art. He was able to watch it without fear. He was certain that the day would come when he would find himself in the same situation. Some inborn sense of survival told him to watch closely and to learn, not only from the victor, but also from the vanquished.
You ever seen one of them big catfish they pulled out of the river? You see the way they flop around when they're gutted? That's how it's going to be with you. I'm going to gut you, then I'm going to watch you flop around.
Riley made a quick slash in motion with his knife, but Harding jumped out of the way. Mistaking Harding's reflexive action as a sign of fear, Riley moved in for the kill, lunging forward. Harding easily sidestepped the lunge, then taking advantage of Riley's awkward and unbalanced position, counter-thrusted with his own knife. Harding stepped back from his adversary as Riley hit the floor belly down. Almost instantly, a pool of blood began spreading beneath him.
Boy!
It wasn't until that moment that Art and the others in the saloon realized that Cooper was holding a double-barreled shotgun and had been throughout the fight.
You look through Riley's pockets there. For your sake and for the sake of your friend there, you'd better come up with McPherson's purse. Because if you don't, I reckon we might have to hang the both of you for murder.
Wait a minute. How can you call this murder? You saw that he drew the knife first. Hell, everyone saw it.
Seems to me like he didn't have much of a choice. You all but called him a thief. If he wasn't a thief, then he had every right to defend his honor.
Art looked at Harding.
Go ahead, Art. If you say Riley has McPherson's wallet, then I've got no doubt but that he does.
At that moment, Riley's accomplice, the man who originally made the pick, started to leave the saloon.
Hold it right there, Carter. If the boy's right, if he finds the wallet, then you're going to be the one we'll be asking questions.
Wait a minute. What if he does find McPherson's purse on Riley? That don't prove I had anything to do with it. It just means that Riley took it.
Everyone agreed that Riley had just come in through the door and didn't come nowhere near the bar. That means if he has McPherson's wallet, the only way he could have it is if you give it to him.
Art knelt beside Riley's body. He hesitated for a moment.
Go on, boy. Look for it.
Nodding, Art took a deep breath and stuck his hand in one of the back pockets.
What you got?
Nothing.
The other back pocket produced the same result. Art tried to turn Riley over, but Riley was a big man, and his inert weight made turning him difficult. Harding started to help him.
You get away from him, Harding! Let the boy do it alone! If he finds that purse, I don't want nobody claiming that somehow you sneaked it to him.
All right.
Riley's eyes were still open, and he was staring directly at Art.
He ain't gonna hurt you none, boy. He's dead. Now get on with it.
Art searched Riley's front pants pockets without success, then reached into one of the man's jacket pockets. He came away empty-handed. Now, there was only one pocket left.
This is it, boy. If it ain't in that pocket, then you done got a man killed for nothing. And don't think it'll go easy on you just 'cause you're young.
It's in there.
Art stuck his hand all the way down and felt the entire pocket. When he pulled his hand out, it was empty.
Ha! I reckon this proves the boy was lying.
Art's stomach tumbled in fear. Almost in desperation, he put his hand back in Riley's jacket pocket. And this time, he felt something. Grabbing it, he realized that whatever he was feeling wasn't actually in the pocket, but was behind a layer of cloth. Something was sewn into the lining of the jacket.
I think I've found it.
Pull it out. Let us see it.
It's behind a cloth. Hold on.
Art picked up Riley's knife.
Yeah. Here it is.
Glory be, that's my purse.
Damn your hide, boy.
Carter drew his pistol. Without thinking, Art jumped to the side. Art saw Carter's chest and face turn into instant ground sausage. Carter pitched backward, dead before he even hit the floor. Cooper held the smoking shotgun.
Freebeard, anyone who helps drag that trash out of here.
I'll help.
Sign me up.
All right. Woo-hoo.
The offer of free beer was all the inducement necessary. It took but a moment to drag the two bodies out into the alley behind the dram shop. Leaving them there, they hurried back inside for their reward. Although neither Art nor Harding joined the detail in dragging the bodies out, they didn't lack for beer. McPherson, whose poke Art had saved, bought a round for each of them. After several rounds, Art was feeling pretty goddamn good.
Well, I think we'd best get moving on, Art.
Well, yeah, I reckon. Does this sort of thing happen often?
Well, what sort of thing?
What sort of thing? The knife fight. I mean, that man was trying to kill you.
Yeah, he was. That's why I killed him.
I never seen anything like that before.
The hell you say. What about the business down on the river?
That wasn't the same thing. The fight on the river happened real quick. This, I don't know. This sort of happened real slow.
Have you thought about what caused us to fight?
You said he wanted to kill you.
Well, yeah. I mean, have you thought about why he wanted to kill me?
I guess because...
Because I asked him to empty his pockets. And the reason I asked him to do that was because you had just accused him of stealing.
Oh. Then I was the cause
of... No, not really. Riley and Carter brought it on themselves. Stealing is not the safest way to make a living out here. If someone plans to make his livelihood that way, then he damn well better be prepared to face the consequences. And in this case, the consequences were pretty severe.
Yeah, I guess they were.
Look, Art. It's like I told you back on the boat when you killed that son of a bitch who was trying to kill me. Life is hard out here. Look around you. You'll see an eagle killing a mouse, a snake killing a frog, and a fox killing a rat. If you aren't ready to face up to that, then you may as well go back home to your mom and papa. You understand?
Yes, sir, I reckon I do.
Good.
But I don't reckon it's ever going to be something I'll enjoy doing. Killing someone, I mean.
Son, I pray to God that you never do get to where you enjoy it. There's a difference between doing something that you have to do to survive and doing it for the pure evil pleasure of it. Even when you stop to think about it, it's those who do take pleasure from it who are going to wind up giving you the most trouble.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's enough teaching for now. I've saved the best for last. Come on, I want you to see the Blue Star.
Blue Star Dram Shop was decidedly more attractive than the other saloons had been. Where the others had been thrown together with unpainted, rip-sawed, raw lumber, the Blue Star was a carefully finished building. The outside was painted white and trimmed in red. It was also a two-story building with a false front that made it look even taller from the street.
It doesn't look like this building got hurt any from the earthquake.
No, but it did. It went down just like the others did. But whereas everyone else has only halfway rebuilt their buildings, Mr. Bellefontaine decided he would return the Blue Star to its original state, complete with paint and all the furnishings. The other bar owners were a little put out with him. And if truth be known, I think most of them are sort of privately hoping that the earthquakes come again to sort of even things out for them. Come on, let's go in. If you think it looks nice from out here, wait till you see the inside.
The inside lived up to Harding's promise. Instead of rough-hewn lumber, the bar was finished mahogany, and behind the bar was a large gilt-edged mirror. Scores and scores of elaborately shaped and colored bottles stood on the counter in front of the mirror, numbered doubled by the reflection. At the back of the room, a finished staircase climbed up to a balcony that overlooked the ground floor. Though he couldn't see it all, he knew that the balcony went as deep as the saloon itself, so there had to be rooms upstairs as well. The interior of the bar was lit not by unfiltered sunlight, as had been the case with the others, but by a brightly shining chandelier. As a result, the windows were closed and no flies were crawling around on the customers' tables. Even these tables, Art noticed, were made of finished wood.
Oh, my!
Impressive, huh? My friend, there is not another dram shop like this on the Mississippi. Not from St. Louis to New Orleans. And I ought to know, because I've been in just about every one of them.
It is beautiful. I don't think I ever seen anything like it.
You can see now why I saved this for last. Here, this one looks like a good table. And as an added attraction, the Blue Star has something that none of the other dram shops have. It has women. Art, meet Lil.
Well, Harden, I hear you had a busy day.
You mean you already heard?
Word of a killing gets around fast, even if it is some no-count like Mo Riley who needed killing.
You knew him?
All the girls knew him, and there won't be any of us shedding any tears over the likes of him.
Art had never seen a woman who looked like Lily. There were dark markings around her eyes. Her lips were as red as ripe cherries, and her cheeks nearly so. The top of her dress was cut way down, and it gapped open so that Art could actually see the swell of the top of her breasts. He couldn't stop staring at her.
Here you go. 3 beers. Enjoy.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Bellefontaine.
Wow. You know everybody, Mr. Harding.
Now everybody knows Bellefontaine. He's the owner of the bar, remember? And he just bought you a beer.
Art picked up the glass and started drinking. Whereas the taste had been somewhat foreign to him when he began the evening's drinking spree, he now found that he liked it. He drank nearly half the mug before he set it down. As he looked at Lily's breasts again, they seemed to be floating there in front of him. His head was spinning, and he felt very peculiar.
You like what you see, Art?
Yes, ma'am.
Art's tongue seemed thick, and he found that he couldn't make it work as easily as he normally could. He pulled his tongue out of his mouth and felt it with his thumb and forefinger, then looked down at it, trying to see it.
I'll say this for your boy, Hardin. He's a polite one, calling me ma'am.
Well, he's not my boy. He's my friend and business partner.
Business partner, is he? He's a fine-looking young boy, I'll give you that. But isn't he a little young to be a business partner?
Well, he was my partner, and he still could be if he wanted to. But he wants to see the creature.
Yeah, see the creature. Uh-huh. Well, it ain't the creature he's been looking at since he come in here. Ain't that right, Sonny?
Yeah.
What's right? I just told your friend here that I don't believe you've been looking at the creature tonight. I think you've been looking somewhere else.
She grabbed Art by the back of his head, then pulled his face right down into her breasts. He could feel the warm, smooth skin against his face, and he reacted quickly, pulling away.
I'm sorry. Hell, Sonny, don't be sorry. If I didn't want men to see my titties, I wouldn't wear clothes like this.
Oh, you're embarrassing him, Lil.
I'm not embarrassing him. I'm giving him an education. Here, Art, as long as we're at it, have yourself a good look.
Lily unbuttoned two more buttons and opened her bodice, exposing her breasts all the way to the nipples.
You like what you see? Do you like my titties?
I think your titties are very nice.
Nice? I have to tell you, Sonny, nice is not a word folks use much around Lily Howard. I do appreciate it, though.
Oh.
Hey, are you a painted woman? A painted woman? Well, yes, I reckon I am.
Come on, Lily. You got a room upstairs, don't you?
Right at the head of the stairs, honey. As if you didn't know that. You've been there enough times.
Well, so I have. But what do you say we go again? I think Art has seen as much of the creature as he needs to see.
I could get Sally to join us. We could teach the boy a thing or two, we could.
The boy has grown a lot since he came to me. But I don't think he's ready to be that grown just yet.
Okay, honey. Whatever you say.
Lily put her hands on Harding's shoulders, leaned against him so that the spill of her breast mashed against his chest, then looked up at him.
Hey, watch that. Else we'll be starting right here.
Smiling, Lily took Harding by the hand and led him to the foot of the stairs. Harding looked back toward his young friend.
Art, I'll be back in a little while. In the meantime, why don't you get something to eat? I think it might do you good.
As Art watched him climb the stairs, it was almost as if he was watching himself watch them leave. He had never felt such a peculiar sense of detachment from his own body.
Another beer, Sonny?
What? Oh, no. No, thank you. I think I'd rather have something to eat, if you've got it.
I got bacon, eggs, taters right here, if that's to your liking.
Well, that'll be fine.
Whoa, hey. You all right, boy? You look a little unsteady on your get-along there.
Yeah, I'm all right. I think I'll just step out back to the privy. I'll be right back.
Take your time, Sonny. Wouldn't want you to wet your pants.
It was quite dark outside, and Art wondered how long he and Harding had been drinking the beer. He wasn't surprised by the dark. He had watched it get progressively darker after each beer, because he'd found it necessary to visit the privy after each one. He had never peed as often as he had been peeing since he arrived in New Madrid.
Well, dag. I hope nothing's wrong with me.
Art turned to go back into the tavern to have his supper. Suddenly, Art saw stars. His ears rang. Then he felt himself falling. After that, everything went to black. Harding awakened to the aroma of coffee. When he opened his eyes, he saw Lily sitting on the edge of the bed, holding a cup.
Mmm, is that for me?
Sure is. I'll just bet you don't get service like this from all your other women.
What other women? You're the only woman for me, Lily. Hell, you know that.
You are full of shit, Mr. Pete Harding. I know at least three other women right here in New Madrid, you've betted.
Well, yeah. But I had to pay them for it.
Here now. What are you trying to do? Cheat a poor working girl out of her money? Of course you had to pay them for it, just like you're going to pay me.
Oh, Lily. Now I'm really hurt. And here I thought you invited me to your place out of love.
Sympathy, maybe. Besides, this is what I do. I'm a, what'd the boy call me? A painted lady.
Oh, shit. Art.
What about him?
I just left him sitting there last night.
I'm sure he'll be all right. He looked like a pretty resourceful young man to me.
He's very resourceful, and about the finest person I ever run into, regardless of his age. But he was also drunk.
He damn sure was. Cute, too.
Oh, but the thing was, he's never been drunk before. I think I better go down and try to find him.
Harding swung his legs over the edge of the bed. As soon as he did so, Lily hiked up her nightgown and straddled him.
Now hold on. He's waited this long. Don't you think he could wait just a little longer? This one is free.
Well, I expect he could wait just a little longer.